It is day 20 of the partial government shutdown, and we continue our look at how Hawaii is being affected. Today, our focus is on some of the federal employees whose jobs have been deemed essential to public safety. Their work includes guarding prison inmates and screening airport passengers. Hawaii Public Radio's Ryan Finnerty spoke with a few of the union leaders to find out what's going on with essential workers who are about to miss their first paycheck.
It's business as usual at the Daniel K. Inouye International Airport in Honolulu. On average, 1.6 million passengers pass through the state's largest airport every month. But none of that would be possible without the hundreds of agents employed by the TSA to screen bags and passengers. Those blue-shirted officers have been deemed essential by the federal government and are still showing up to work despite the partial shutdown. Joshua Christie is with the American Federation of Government Employees, the union representing TSA workers.
So we have 600 employees plus, at least here in Honolulu, that are coming to work without pay. As for furloughed, there's only 48 throughout the Pacific that are considered furloughed that are not coming to work. The rest of us are considered essential. So we have to come to work. If we don't come to work, we are considered intermittent furloughed. And those days we don't show up probably will not get paid, depending on what Congress passes in the new funding.
Since congressional funding lapsed 3 weeks ago, the operating budgets for nine cabinet departments have slowly been running out. 800,000 federal employees have been sent home or forced to work without pay. If nothing changes in Washington, Friday will mark the first time they miss a paycheck.
Some people say they can go this long, but if it keeps going on longer, they don't know what they're going to do. Some are calling out looking for other jobs in the meantime because some are living paycheck to paycheck. We do have some workers that both the husband and wife are working for the federal government in some capacity, and they're not getting paid. So they're looking for other opportunities. We've had some that have just had children that just gave birth. So they're out and they're not getting paid. Their health insurance should still be covered. But once again, the child care for some people is a big thing, and picking their children up from school. They need those sitters, and they need that paycheck to help pay for that.
Many screeners have taken to driving for Lyft and Uber to pay their bills. Several major airports on the mainland have been experiencing a shortage of screeners as many TSA officers opt to take sick leave. It's being called the blue flu.
There have been approval by some of our upper management to go on leave, yes. But as for the blue flu that the national media is reporting, that has not hit our airport yet. And I don't think it will. We're still encouraging the members of TSA, the workers, to come to work because they are considered essential.
The challenges aren't confined to the Honolulu airport. Rick Carr is an executive vice president with the AFGE union and lives on the Big Island.
Well, the morale is very low because everybody is expecting their next check and is not coming. Unless this thing opens up on Friday, that check is gone because that's the pay period where we get our next check. So morale is very, very low. And people are asking, what do we do? Where do we go? People are forced to go out and get part-time jobs, which can affect their other jobs, you know, but they're going to pay for they're going to feed their children first. We have this one woman who has four children. She's expecting her fifth child in February, and she doesn't know what she's going to do. There are other stories, you know, the Kona side. The Kona is very, very expensive to live there, and a lot of people are sharing apartments and everything else. Because rent is, you know, it's in demand. It's sky high. It's just unbelievable. And they're saying, our landlord, you know, he can rent that apartment. They're afraid of, you know, that could lead to eviction and everything else. Because the first month, you know, it's coming up real quick.
The TSA has more than 200 employees on the Big Island. Carr says that many of them are at the edge of their financial safety net.
The majority of them are all payday to payday. So we're talking now. I mean, basically, the check that they're expecting Friday, Saturday, or Monday, depending on your bank, that's it. You're not getting your next check. As far as money goes, we're at a critical period.
Despite those stresses, Carr says he is firmly against a strike or the coordinated use of sick leave. He said officers remain committed to public safety.
The different areas that are operating will operate and continue to operate in a safe manner. Whether we have the staffing to bring in the lines as quickly as we want to, who can say?
According to union reps, members of the flying public have been supportive of the TSA officers working without pay, offering food and words of solidarity. But another group of federal employees will likely not receive that kind of encouragement from the public: prison workers. They operate outside the view of most Americans, but are experiencing the same plight as TSA agents. Dwayne Bautista works for the Bureau of Prisons on Oahu and represents the Prison Workers Union.
In Hawaii, we have a total of 200 staff. Currently, right now, everyone's working without pay.
That includes everyone from corrections officers to maintenance staff.
There's a little dark cloud over us. Everyone's worrying about when is the next paycheck or when is this government going to open up so they can we can still go on with our daily lives, meaning with our bills, to provide for our families, our kids.
Bautista says that some officers have been taking personal and sick leave during the shutdown, although that isn't abnormal for this time of year. But many officers are still having to work extra hours.
Officers do take leave unexpectedly or unplanned, but I know for a fact that we've been getting mandated doing 16-hour shifts because certain shifts are it's not assigned to an officer is not assigned, or it's basically short. So we're doing 16 hours. It's going to take a toll. I mean, we're doing 16 hours back-to-back, sometimes two or three, and it's all because where we at with this shutdown, like I said, some officers are on scheduled leave. Some officers have emergencies, but that's just where we at right now.
All the union reps expressed hope that Congress would authorize back pay once the government does finally reopen, as was the case in the 16-day shutdown in 2013. Union leaders are also working with the state of Hawaii to see if the affected federal workers can receive unemployment benefits during the shutdown, but that likely won't be possible until they miss a full month's pay. I'm Ryan Finnerty for The Conversation.
And you can listen back to all our coverage of the partial government shutdown at hawaiipublicradio.org. On Monday, we'll hear how the Coast Guard is coping with the lapse in funding. This is The Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz.
Aloha, my name is Renee Tillotson. I'm the director and owner of Still and Moving Center, and I'm an underwriter of HBR. I've had students thank me for supporting some of their favorite programs. I think it's a matter of sharing the goodwill, knowing that Still and Moving Center is a place that is a contributor to the overall community.
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting, your message heard here.
If you tuned in last week on Says You, you learned lots of things, like the ins and outs of snake charming.
Are there a lot of apprentice snake charmers? I'm just curious.
Apprentice. Some of them suffer from reptile dysfunction, I might add.
I don't even know where we are anymore. I'm going to have to...
And what will you learn this week on Says You? Who knows?
This evening at 6:30.
It's now time for our reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Reporter Marcel Henri has been tracking the rail project. He posted a story online just about an hour ago about a new audit out. Morning, Marcel.
Morning, Catherine. Good to be here.
So refresh our memory. This is something that was mandated by state lawmakers, right?
That's right. So in late 2017, you might remember, the state had to bail out for the second time the island's rail project when it ran into budget troubles yet again. And so part of that bailout package was this mandate for the state auditor to take a look at HART, the Honolulu Authority for Rapid Transportation, which is overseeing the rail project, and to check out its management practices, its fiscal policies, and the like, to just get a better handle on what's happening and why costs had risen so steeply to that point.
And this is just the first of a couple of reports out, right?
It's actually the first of what I understand will be four reports that will be released by the state auditor's office over the next several weeks. So it's going to be probably a long month for heart, to be honest, as those trickle out.
And what's the snapshot?
Yeah, so this first report, it's really interesting reading for anybody who's been following this project for the past several years, and anybody who's very invested in the project and what's been going on with it. It really outlines and details the troubles and the history of the past decade, some of the missteps in terms of issuing contracts. But really one of the interesting things that this first chapter in the audit homes in on is 2014 to 2016, which is when costs really spiked. They almost doubled in that period to build rail. And, you know, that's not really news to anybody. But, you know, this was an extensive audit that looked at thousands of pages and hundreds of emails, dozens of interviews and the like. And they really found some interesting instances where it was clear that HART had its own internal projections and cost estimates and schedule estimates that weren't looking very good at the time. But they were basically keeping this kind of close to the vest and weren't informing the public immediately or in a timely manner of what these projections were. They were still sharing, you know, some more optimistic or rosier projections at that point. And that, for me, you know, this audit's kind of new, just came out, but that's like the real takeaway is what basically, you know, what HART knew and when did they know it, kind of thing.
Right. And then when did they tell the board, right?
Not just the public, what were they telling their board at the same time? One of the conflicts between the auditor's office and HART was this conflict over sharing executive session minutes with the board. You know, when the board goes behind closed doors and meets, the auditor's office really alerted in its report that it wasn't getting these minutes, and that's kind of throwing a damper on really getting to the core of the question of what the board knew exactly. But they did find enough that showed that, you know, HART was not updating even the board along with the public on some of the more timelier cost and schedule estimates.
Right. And that eventually led to the removal of Dan Grabauskas, the former HART executive director.
Right. And a lot of these executive session minutes, you know, they spent a lot of time. They spent months back in 2016 behind closed doors and a focus on Grabauskas's job evaluation. So a lot of this does tie into that.
And I remember being at Grabauskas's news conference, I think there was another review that came out that was pretty scathing. But you also reached out to his number two guy.
Yeah, I managed to talk to Brendan Morioka, who's a deputy director at the time, and he had some interesting comments on the state of HART at the time, and Dan Grabauskas did have a lot of leeway in Morioka's view in terms of what information went out, and he did kind of raise questions as to whether things should have been released earlier.
I don't know. Was he kind of like throwing his boss, his former boss, under the train?
he was being cautious, but they were some interesting comments for sure from Brennan.
And the city's reply?
Well, HART is not. It pointed out some small details, but overall, it did not dispute the findings of the audit.
Okay, so I'm sure there's going to be more about this developing today as folks get their hands on it and kind of go through the pages.
Yeah, and more reports to come in the coming weeks.
All right. Okay. Thanks a lot, Marcel.
Sure. Thanks, Catherine.
That was reporter Marcel Henry with today's reality check. To read his full story, visit civilbeat.org. This is The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Ulana, We've watched a lot of changes in Kaka'ako in the past few decades. Once a section of Honolulu was home to many small automotive businesses, including a classic Chevy specialist, Auto Diagnostics. Over time, some of these businesses have needed to relocate to make way for new buildings and high-rises. Some of them have required certain areas to be reconfigured to accommodate the changes, and we have one such building in mind. It was built in 1989 and has a Kapi'olani Boulevard address. Its construction caused one street to drop off the map altogether and another to be shortened. Our backyard quiz for today, what's the name of the building? And for extra credit, what are the names of the streets fully or partially consolidated in the building's footprint? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Taylor McCarthy from Wahiwa. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Hawaii logged its first pedestrian fatal Monday night, just hours after our call-in show about pedestrian safety. 86-year-old Makbul Ulrahman was hit as he crossed a Hawaikai street near where a crosswalk was said to be mistakenly removed. State Representative Gene Ward fired off an urgent letter to the city this week asking that the crosswalk be immediately repainted.
You know, first, my heart goes out to the Rahman family whose father was... short-shifted in terms of what the city and county did 2 years ago when they started eliminating crosswalks. I think when they did it, and they didn't do it just in Hawaiʻi, they did it in a number of neighborhoods, but they did this one in Hawaiʻi directly in front of a preschool and directly in front of the Oahu Club. A lot of traffic going back and forth, a lot of mama bears complaining that, hey, my kids are in danger. Why did you allow them to do that? So we jumped on the issue, and they said, oh, we made a mistake. So the first thing was a very honest thing, saying, hey, we made a mistake. And they did make they made mistakes in other places, too. But then they came back saying, oh, by the way, the rules say we got to do an EIS before we put in a crosswalk. I said, come on, don't insult the intelligence of the people of Hawaii and the people of Hawaii by saying you got to do an EIS because the thing was there. And they said, okay, okay. And then 2 weeks later, they came back with another one. Oh, now we got to do an ADA. You know, God bless those who are in wheelchairs. But the fact that now they're saying they got to jackhammer the curb to make it ADA compliant, and that's going to take to get out to bid and do this and that another 2 years. Well, I am rather outraged that bureaucratic handling is now has resulted in a death, something that was likely preventable. I mean, we can't say just because the keys were in the car that somebody stole it. We can't say because there wasn't a crosswalk that he was injured and killed. But the probability is that the crosswalk, if it was there, he would have used it. So the logic is, come on, let's get off this bureaucratic crap and get on with 45 minutes. You can repaint the white stripes and make that make it good again. You can put that crosswalk back in. I understand the city and county is not responding to you guys in the media. They must fear probably some legal liability, but it's all the more reason if they are fearing legal liability, get the damn thing back in and not have any liability like they may have by keeping it out and using all these other excuses.
So this was something that came up at the neighborhood board, the concern about the removal of that crosswalk.
2 years ago, it came up as a widespread thing in the board and in the community. And it was an outrageous thing because why would you choose that one of all the ones to choose? And they never said why they did it, but they said, oh, it was a mistake. So it's been festering for 2 years, and now they're saying it's going to take 2 more years to do the bids and jackhammer the curb and repaint it, which is total nonsense as far as I'm concerned. Government can do better than that. They've got a lesson here in front of them that shows there's going to be some real difficulties, and the communities are, quite frankly, not up in arms, but there's not yet pitchforks and torches, but this kind of behavior by our government is not acceptable. And it embarrasses me as the state representative and the representative from Hawaii that we can't do a better job than this.
There is lots of concern because we saw the number of cases of pedestrian fatals jump last year, almost triple. And there has been a push at the beginning of this year to remind people, stay safe, watch out, be careful.
Well, Catherine, I've got two bills that are pending introduction. One I had introduced in the past, and that is for the intersections that are the most dangerous, and by the fatalities and the accidents, they should all have flashing lights and LED in the pavement. The second bill that I'm just now in the process of forming is that there should be reflective lights, not lights, just reflectors, with a nail that pounds them into the white sides of the crosswalk, to at nighttime people will be able to see that, oh my God, whether they're orange or blue, they'll see a reflective strip across the crosswalk, so people will know, hey, there could be people in that thing. And it's a very inexpensive fix. It just takes the political will to get it out. So I'm introducing that bill. We shouldn't allow this as a continual thing for older people or anybody crossing the street and getting cut down. It's totally unacceptable.
Why didn't your first bill pass? What was the objection there?
Because the DOT said, oh, that's too expensive. Flashing lights? I said, well, it's the one that you use solar. And they said, well, you got to dig up the pavement. You got to dig up maybe a half inch of, you can basically strip it with a saw and then embed the LED lights. There are a lot of places on the mainland that they're doing that, and they've done it at some severe places, I think in Kalihi already. They've got one on King Street, I know, near Metcalf. It's a light. As soon as somebody gets into the crosswalk, these lights flash on both sides of the street. And to me, that's not rocket science. To me, that's not busting the bank when we can save lives.
The city did say that if there are areas where the crosswalks are faded, to let the city know. So they were encouraging people to please flag these areas.
Well, that's encouraging to hear, but it sounds like a little bit too much too late, quite frankly, in this regard. When we've been saying for 2 years, put the thing back in, and they haven't put it back in, and they've thrown obstacle after obstacle. So it's good. Hopefully they're changing their tune after this, but it's something where we should not relent, and I'm glad that your station is picking up and going to broadcast this, because people, quite frankly, find it unacceptable for taking away the crosswalk in front of children's and recreational facilities in Hawaii.
Had you reached out to the family? I understand that the gentleman who died had only recently moved over here to be with his son.
Be with his son, who works for the HART, the rail project, the mass transit project. I understand they're initially from Pakistan. It's just a real tragedy. I haven't got any response from the mayor yet. I was hoping that would be where the solution might lie. But I'm sure we're going to double team it, Senator Chang and Councilman Ozawa, myself. I know we're all on the same sheet of music of protecting the people of Hawaii, particularly if it's something that government can do on its own and have it completed without 2 years of waiting and postponing the development of what should be done.
And when is the next neighborhood board meeting in your area?
It's always the last Tuesday of the month, so it'll be the end of this month, probably in the 20, I forget what the last Tuesday of the month is, but I'm sure that's going to be hot on the agenda, and people want to hear answers. People in Hawaii Kai keep our feet to the fire as elected officials. They want to hear answers and why there's inaction, and why did we wait till somebody got hit in that particular area before we put the thing back? And we got a mayor's representative, a good gentleman, Tim Houghton, who I'm sure is going to be preparing for these remarks that a lot of the members in the board as well as the community are going to be asking for. So he wasn't in the crosswalk, but he was near the crosswalk, and that's why it, quote, could be preventable. If there was a crosswalk there, the probability he could use it, I mean, we don't know, but the fact that it's not there, that's why, because of its proximity, people are saying, you know, let's get that crosswalk back in before it's a young kid or somebody going to the preschool or the Wahoo Club. It's kind of a wake-up call, if you look at it that way, Catherine. It's like saying, hey, 2 years, we haven't done anything. You guys are dragging your feet. Come on, let's get on with it. And unfortunately, we had to have a death to wake us up to that reality.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you, Catherine. Hopefully this will be solved by the Neighborhood Board. I hope you guys can come, and I hope the people of Hawaii come and express their opinion on how sad we are. But again, regards to the and sympathies and the Raman family for all of us from Hawaii.
All right.
In regards to them.
Thank you.
Aloha.
That was Republican Representative Gene Ward, who was asking the city to please restripe the crosswalk that it mistakenly took out before anyone else gets hurt. The city has declined comment at this time.
Americana band Discord and Rye returns to the Atherton Studio on January 19th. They'll be showcasing a new lineup, new songs, and rearranged fan favorites. If you're looking for some genuine rock and roots music, make your reservations today at hawaiipublicradio.org. Station members enjoy discounted pricing. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Kamoela Philharmonic Orchestra on Hawaii Island, presenting the winners of its annual Youth Concerto Competition Sunday, January 27th, 4 p.m. at Kahilu Theater in Waimea. KamoelaPhil.org.
About 100 years ago, the Russian composer Stravinsky wrote the classic production of The Soldier's Tale, L'Histoire du Soldat. But have you heard it in Hawaiian? Well, listen to this.
I am a vaina o hilo lawa o kona, e hoi ai ke kahi koa I kona hale. Hulu wale no kāna no ka ho'omaha ana mai ke kaua. Hele vāvai oia, ho'omaha, kia moe, ala a hele hou wale aku. O ka hele ka hana mau a ke koa.
We sat down with director Todd Farley to talk about an upcoming adaptation of the classic with Chamber Music Hawaii entitled Mo'olelo o Ke Koa.
It seemed to give itself over to a Hawaiian interpretation. I had performed the piece before with the Pasadena Symphony and had wanted to remount it here in Hawaii, yet the storyline itself didn't seem appropriate. You know, it's based in the concept of a soldier returning home from war there in Europe. And yet, the struggle that the character had with the devil and materialism and the concepts of feeling displaced from culture and society after struggle and war was an easy parallel into Hawaiian histories and the Hawaiian history of wrestling with colonization as well as materialism that was brought along with colonization. So as I started to look at it, it just fell into place just to be a perfect story to be retold in a Hawaiian context.
So you grew up in Hilo.
That's
so
right.
What did you use in the Hawaiian culture, and how does it blend into this?
Well, so first off, I decided to place it in Hilo as far as its setting. So the soldier starts his journey from Kona side on his way to Hilo. It's placed in like the late 1800s, early 1900s as far as the setting. So colonization has just started to take place. And they're just, at this point, the Hawaiian people are starting to wrestle with that idea. So the devil enters into the scene to tempt our soldier, our warrior, Koa, with the idea of being able to see the future and to gain financial gains and wealth as is defined in European standards. And he exchanges his own violin, which he has, for this book of futures. And thus begins this terrible journey into to wealth as a means of trying to find happiness, which, of course, is ever elusive. And then in the second part, he departs from that and he goes to a colonized foreign land. And in that land, he discovers a princess who he heals of her malady and rediscovers life, only to lose it again to the wiles of the devil and trying to blend his past and his present and his future together. It's a classic story of you know, a man meets devil, makes a negotiation, and then loses out.
Right. You make a pact with the devil and, oh, boy.
And it'll bite you back. That's right.
And so did this just come to you?
I was in discussion with Joe Stapek from the University of Hawaii, and we were discussing various projects that we wanted to do in integrating mime movement, Hawaiian theater with instrumentation, classical music. And this piece came up because it's actually the 100th anniversary of Stravinsky's Soldier's Tale, or Histoire de Soldat, as a piece that would be relevant for the times. Again, relevant as reinterpreted to the Hawaiian context. So we started to play around with how we would do that at the University of Hawaii, where I am currently finishing up my own MFA. And he had contact with the Chamber Music Hawaii, who was wanting to celebrate that 100th as well. So he said, well, why don't we join up with them and have a discussion? In our first discussions, we talked about maybe doing the production in Pidgin and English and Hawaiian mix, and or perhaps even recasting the whole story into a Hawaiian pre-colonial context. But as we talked to various kumu and various other historians as well as our Hawaiian leaders of theater, it became apparent that the best story would be actually told completely in Hawaiian, with English subtext or supertext for those who don't speak Hawaiian, and just to parallel the interpretation. So I translated the original French text to English, and then we had a Hawaiian team translate my English into Hawaiian, and then had the cast who's actually performing it in Hawaiian critique it and tweak it and find it so that it's natural for them. And then Kumu Haile Baker from the University of Hawaii, she's our theater expert as far as Hawaiian theater, and she helped critique the context of that and sort of mold it so that we could have these parallelisms take place in a appropriate way. One of the techniques that we use in translating, I'm also a theologian, and I work with languages, ancient languages, Hebrew, Latin, Greek. And one of the traditions that you have in translation is either a literal translation or a figurative translation. And the idea was to take a literal translation of the story, but to change the places, the symbols, the ideas to the Hawaiian parallel. And it worked perfect. So, for instance, there's a scene where the devil is challenging the soldier to dress appropriately as a person who's an appropriate warrior. And the warrior, our warrior, Koa, always picks the Hawaiian implement, the Hawaiian helmet, the Hawaiian battle axe. And the devil says, no, that's not right. Here's a fencing foil. Oh, no, that's not right. You know, here's a army helmet. And there's just this perfect, wonderful story parallel where we can show the contrast between European culture and a Hawaiian culture inside the story. And again, as we discussed that and as we worked that through with advisors, the context of the school, with the symphony, it just fell into place.
It's magical when that happens, huh?
Oh, it really is. And it's quite delightful that you know, a story that was written 100 years ago just seamlessly fit with inside of this particular context.
Right. It finds new life
right.
Within a different culture.
That's right. And it's exciting because it's there was a tradition here in Hawaii since the late 1800s to translate classical texts, European texts even, into the Hawaiian language. So in this renaissance of the Hawaiian language, in the renaissance of so much that's taking place within Hawaiiana, it's exciting to see something like that re-emerge where we're finding classical works of European history, finding a Hawaiian interpretation in Hawaiian appropriate place.
And then what about the music part of it?
The music stays the same. So the music is absolutely what Stravinsky wrote. And, you know, that was a question of whether or not we should translate it into Hawaiian instrumentation or whether or not that. But again, if the whole concept of the story is this wrestling between colonization and European ideas and Hawaiian ideas, the music works very, very well. For instance, there are various scenes where the devil's playing the violin. And it's the sound of that violin that's changing the scene and overcoming and tempting the queen, the princess Koa, inside of our story. So it actually becomes a fabulous instrument of communication of what that struggle actually is.
Okay, so no touch of ukulele or steel guitar.
No, there's not. You know, and again, that was a real conscious choice of saying, what would have that been? And once we started to, if we would have reinterpreted the music in it, which is certainly a viable option, and perhaps in the future someone will do that to the translations. But in this case, it served our purpose quite well to bring the contrast even more starkly so into the story.
Like you said, the juxtaposition.
Exactly.
The yin and yang, you're like.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. It'll be a very unique experience for all who can come. We have two venues for it. The first one is this January 14th at 7:30 at Doris Duke. That is here, you know, on the Lulu side. And then our second performance will be over at Palaku on Friday, January the 18th, again at 7:30. And people can go online there at chambermusichawaii.org to purchase their tickets. And I do so. We only have the two performances scheduled at this point, you know. And it's, again, going to be a very interesting combination of music, mime, Hawaiian language, as well as dance and physical theater. I would say that for all who are interested, one of the things that sometimes people wonder is, well, am I going to understand this story if it's completely in Hawaiian? We have the subtext. Supertext at one theater and subtext at the other. And it is also very physicalized. So they see the story through my art form, which is mime. I'm a Marsoyan-trained artist. And so they see the story as well as hear the story, read the story, and, of course, the music embodies it.
That was director Todd Farley, who has lived both here and in France, talking about the upcoming adaptation of The Soldier's Tale, Les Histoires du Soldat. He tells us there are more collaborations of classics reimagined in the Hawaiian culture in the pipeline. This morning, we went looking for a couple of Kaka'ako streets that fully or partially disappeared to make way for a high-rise built in 1989. At that time, many of the businesses in the area were small automotive specialists, and we gave you one hint, Auto Diagnostics. It specialized in classic Chevy repair and maintenance and relocated to allow the construction of Pacific Park Place. The other parts of the answer we were looking for, well, the streets involved in the reconfiguration were Marmion and Emily. Marmion went into the history books, and part of Emily still remains, with the rest being consolidated into the footprint of the building. That's the answer, thanks to a longtime listener who also happens to be a 57 Chevy owner for today's quiz. No winner today. We stumped you on that one. But if you have an idea for the backyard quiz that you'd like to share, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Last month, we rolled out a new segment focusing on Hawaii's forests and gardens. We had a conversation with landscape consultant Heidi Bornhorst about the Hawaiian lunar calendar. Today, we talked to Kauai author Karen Liling about a new book she wrote about native Hawaiian species. She says it's a more condensed and user-friendly version of one she compiled years ago. And she jokingly calls herself the Mata as she propagates the plants.
Well, it all started when I became a volunteer at the National Tropical Botanical Garden. And I was there for 3 years. One day, one of the employees came to one of our meetings and asked if anybody would grow native plants for a Plant of the Month giveaway. I volunteered because around the same time I became interested in natives when I learned that most of the plants I thought that were native were not, from a tropical plant identification course at the community college here. So when I started growing the plants, I just started doing research on them, like where they were from and how rare they were and their isolated areas they lived in. And it was like a light bulb went on in my head to where I just went, oh my gosh, they're so beautiful and people know so little about them.
And I'm thumbing through the book as we speak, and you've got these wonderful sections. You know, it's everything from, you know, how do you transplant? How do you manage your greenhouse? You talk about pests. I mean, it really does go through each type of plant, each native plant.
Well, I did get hired by the gardens eventually to become their native plant propagator. And actually, the first book I wrote was called Growing Hawaii's Native Plants, which was a book I put together with all my notebooks that I kept during the 10 years I worked there and did the research on the native plants. So I first wrote a book that covers every native genus on the islands, and then I was approached to make a condensed version of my book, so more gardeners and people that are just doing native plants on the weekends feel more familiar with the smaller book and covers only 25 plants instead of, you know, 1,000.
Right, everything so, under the sun.
yes. I want to make it easy for people to just feel comfortable, like you said, to just open it up, look at the page, you know, the plant that you're interested in growing, and feel comfortable to grow it from beginning to outplanting.
I love your section on pest control because I have a problem with ants and some other kind of thing that I haven't quite identified yet that is basically sucking the life out of my jacaranda. Tell us about the experience that you had dealing with these pests.
Well, working at in my nursery in a protected little area, I noticed that when the plants started to decline, usually I found ants associated with creating mealy bugs or aphids because the ants are farmers, and they actually will go collect mealy bugs and aphids and scale and put them on your plants so they could farm them and live actually in the soil of the plant or close to the plant. So I had to learn from experience on how to battle the insects and the slugs and the snails, and it just went on, and I almost felt like I became an expert on insects and how to identify them and identify their damage that they were doing to the plants. And so it was a challenge, let's say.
So a lot of this is trial and error. I'm looking at your.
Yes, all of it is trial and error.
I'm looking at your bait for most ants, and you have water, sugar, boric acid, creamy peanut butter, and you mix in a blender until syrupy.
It's either a protein ant or a sugar ant. It kind of attracts both. And then when they eat it with the boric acid in it, it actually dehydrates them. And it dehydrates the entire nest, and then they pass.
What about slugs? Because that's a big deal.
Well, slugs, oh my gosh. There's different kind of baits and stuff, but sorry to admit, I actually just cut them in half. The slugs are so damaging to native plants. It's just incredible.
I mean, I have tried beer, and they just drink the beer and go away, I think.
Yes, and this is what I find works the best. And I live in a wet area, Oahu on Kauai, so I have slugs everywhere. So I don't mess with them. I just cut them in half, and that's the end of it.
Okay, and the slug pellets?
The slug bait, again, you're killing. It's a chemical out, and it's just so much easier just to smash it or do that instead of, like, have to go and get chemicals to kill them. But I look for slug damage, and so, you know, there'll be holes in the leaves or a slime trail. So you just go look for the slug. It'll be close by, and then I take care of it.
And what about hunting down bugs, you know, let's say maybe that are easier found at a particular time of day?
Well, you know, Chinese rose beetles eat holes in a lot of the rarest native plants, a lot of the butylin and the hibiscodelphus plants, which aren't mentioned in this book, but in my other book. And they come out at night, and just to have a simple night light on near the plant will control that without chemicals. So that's a real easy fix, is the night guys that come.
The night bloomers? Or the
Well, the night eaters.
Night eaters, there you go.
The plants at night.
And so do you have a favorite native plant?
Oh, I have so many. I'm really into Pokalakala, which is a native tree to Kauai and only found on Kauai and nowhere else in the entire world. And I just find it a very special plant.
Explain to us what that is.
Well, it's in the octopus tree family. And it's a native that got here a million years ago. Who knows? And it established, you know, its seeds probably floated here, and it established itself on Kauai, which is the oldest island, 6 million years old, and then didn't spread to the other islands, which is unusual. And so they renamed it, but I'm not recognizing it with its new name, sorry to say. It's Monrodendron racemosa, but it's just a special tree. And like I said, I feel like with the native plants and why I'm so passionate about them is we need to show them respect for their journey on how they came to the islands, because they came without the aid of man and by, you know, wind, wave, or wing. So I think that's just a special journey. And that's kind of where my heart is with natives. I just feel everybody should have a certain spot in their yard for a native plant, at least one.
Now, last month, somebody gave me a kole. I was just so thrilled. It was so pretty that during the Arbor Day giveaway, I ended up getting a kole tree because I wanted to be able to make lei. If you're really into lei and there's certain flowers that, you know, you may want to cultivate in your garden.
Yes, and kole does kind of grow to be a large tree, so you do need the room. The thing about natives, a lot of the natives, the hibiscus are very gorgeous, and they should be used more. There's just in the back of my book, you can see a picture of all the native hibiscus just in my yard. And they're very colorful and gorgeous, but a lot of the natives aren't necessarily used for lei. Ohia, of course, ohia lehua. But I look at it more of not how I can use them, but more how I can help them.
There you go.
I don't know if you understand that.
Yes,
but.
Yes, yes. And what about things like mylei?
Well, actually, I planted a mylei tree in my yard about 25 years ago, and I never collected it and made lei out of it. I just kind of let it go. And it became very aggressive and grew up a ohia and snapped an ohia in half. And it created many seedlings. It created seeds and many seedlings on the ground. And now I have to dig up the mylei out of my yard and pot them up in 4-inch pots into 1 gallons, and then I sell them. But it's actually a weed in my yard now.
Interesting.
And it's just amazing that some of these plants that people look like, oh, mylei only grows in the mountain, or koa only grows in the mountain, you know, the mountain koa. You know, it's just amazing. My yard is kind of an example that these plants are very adaptable, and they'll pretty much grow anywhere as long as you give them what they need.
Is there any, I don't know, any particular myth that you want to bust as far as success?
Well, that's interesting you say that. Koa tree, the mountain koa, I think has gotten a bad rap because they say it only grows in the mountains. But in my yard at 300 feet, I have a mountain koa from Kokei growing right next to a lowland koa, and they're actually intertwined, so they're like holding hands.
Oh, that's
and
a neat image.
And then there's mountain ohias growing with ocean plants, nio, right next to each other. So I kind of like to, kind of in my yard, in my native forest, I like to create examples of just just because it's from the ocean doesn't necessarily mean it has to grow near the ocean, you know.
So maybe the message is to gardeners out there, try it.
Yes,
they might
try
like it.
Exactly, try it. And your heart has to be in it because they need help, because they're not used to the insects. They're not used to beetles eating the seeds. It's just, they're just attacked. In my yard, I have chickens that are digging them up, and we have wild pigs that come in the yard. And even in my native forest, I'm attacked by wild pigs, even in a residential area. So it's like, you know, you have to protect them because they need protection, because they don't have defenses to these introduced insects and animals that live on the islands now.
Right. So this book is a nice little how to save our plants, how to
yes.
save our natives.
Yes. And they should be saved because, you know, they do have a fantastic journey, and everybody should learn their journey.
Well, thank you very much for sitting down with us.
Oh, sure. I really appreciate your interest in native plants.
Well, it's a nice little book, I think, for gardeners to pick up. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was Karen Liling, a voice from the Garden Isle, talking about her latest book, Native Hawaiian Plants, How to Grow, Cultivate, and Enjoy 25 Popular Plants.
This is public radio, but we wanted to give you the flavor of these literary events. The best of Aloha Shots is going on the road. Maybe some of you guys never heard of Aloha Shots, but Garen's, this show is the real thing. Get poems and stories by local writers, read by actors, and that wahine with the sexy voice, Noi Tanigawa, hosting the whole shebang. Plus, choke live music. Check them out at hprtickets.org.
Sponsored in part by Servco.
Okay, that's it for today. Up tomorrow, we talk lessons learned. Not only do we mark the one-year anniversary of the false missile alert this weekend, but remember we had to deal with major natural disasters back-to-back. What was your experience? Call our TalkBack line at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation. And we're on iTunes, too. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.